Europe introduces a new round of coronavirus restrictions, but is it time for governments to look longer term and start being a little more honest about how long this pandemic might actually last? In the US, Senate hearings for conservative Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett drew to a close. We ask what we've learned so far and look back on a busy week in American politics. And in an unusual move, we end proceedings with soup, specifically a dispute that's bubbling between Ukraine and Russia over borscht, as the former seeks cultural heritage designation for the dish. Monocle's editors sample these topics today on the Late Edition here on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to the Late Edition. It's Friday the 16th of October and I'm Josh Fennett and I'm joined here in Studio One here at Midori House by our editor, Andrew Tuck, and by Monocle's head of radio, Tom Edwards. Welcome both back to the show. Andrew, it's Friday. I want to know how the week's treated you so far, but I can also tell our listeners that I've read your column, which comes out tomorrow on Saturday, and I know that you've been propping up the bar this week. Is this, are the rumours true?
It's good, the things you can get on your expense account, isn't it? A dreary conversation, but an important one. The world of new measures, of COVID responses, of quarantines. Here in London, we have another round of controls being instituted, one of which is that from this weekend, you can't go to the pub indoors with anybody who doesn't live in your household, unless I think you're in a bubble with somebody who you're taking care of. Anyway, so to make the most of it, my neighbours made it very clear that we would be going to the pub on Thursday night, and a jolly time was had. But so the column is a little bit about the role that the pub plays and why it's important not to think this is just, you know, hospitality being, you know, put out to grass for a little while. It's really important because many other things begin to unravel once you lose these institutions.
And Tom, I have the deep displeasure of sitting opposite you for work, and this week you've been huffing and puffing like a fairy tale wolf. You've been hissing like a Pirelli with a puncture. Is everything all right? Is there something that you need to tell us?
I didn't realize this was going to be quite so
therapeutic,
rigorous. It's like being on the psychiatrist's chair. No, I mean, some drinks have been taken in the Edwards household this week. Is that what you're getting at? Did I open a box of wine? Yes, I did. Was it 2.25 litres? Yes, it was. Did I see it off? I'll leave that to the listeners' imaginations.
I just know that you've been busy, Tom, and I like people to know that as well. A lot of nasty rumours going around that you've had your feet up this week. I want to dispel those. But now it's time for our first story. And let's begin here in Europe. As cases of coronavirus continue to rise across the continent, governments have been doling out new restrictions. From a citywide curfew in Paris and seven other French cities to right here in London, which will move into high alert, a level on a traffic light system that's already looking like a speed bump to progress a few short days after it was implemented. Earlier this week, we heard from Monocle's health and science correspondent, that's Dr. Chris Smith, and he explained why lockdowns may curb infection rates, but are really, in some sense, just delaying the inevitable.
I am sceptical, and the reason I'm sceptical, I think it's an information deficit. I haven't actually seen the case made for if we do this, this happens, if we do this, this happens, and this is how certain we are behind these numbers. Remember, it's only a short while ago that someone said, we are going to shut pubs at 10 o'clock at night, and this is going to reduce cases. This is going to reduce transmission. Yes, it will reduce transmission in the pub, but what models and maths equations don't foresee is the predictable unpredictability of people, which is they then go out of the pub, melee in the street, mass transmission out there, or all back to someone else's place mentality with a whole bunch of bottles of takeout. And far more transmissions in that setting. So I think on the one hand, if you just ask the question, would a lockdown translate into fewer cases? Answer, yes. If you then ask the question slightly differently, what are the long-term repercussions of this? Does this actually translate into a long-term difference in the trajectory, difference in outcome? Will more people die later, just not today? Those are the sorts of questions we need to see set out so that we can all be involved in the decision making, because at the moment it's coming across as a bit of some people with big brains have said this and this is what we're going to do based on some other input from some economists. And I don't think it's transparent enough, and I think it's now is critical more than ever to take the public along for the journey too. because that is missing at the moment. Morale is falling, support is wavering, and if we're going to make these things work, evidence proves to us we have to have everyone on board, on side, and all acting together decisively. Otherwise, we're just fiddling while Rome burns.
Lucid and lively comments from Monocle's very own Big Brain, our health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith there. Now, Andrew, you actually conducted that interview earlier this week. You ran over time, which you were censured for by the producers, and rightly. But this is a really big issue. You spoke to Chris earlier this week. You personally and all of us here will be subject to UK lockdowns as of today. Is the government being transparent about what's happening here, or are we just being drip-fed information about the next few weeks when we should really be talking about the next few months and more?
I think what's interesting is in every country there is a different debate happening this time with the second wave. The first time, everybody was on board with the measures. Everybody understood that there needed to be, you know, this severe lockdown to squash the sombrero, to whatever the terminology was. This time, people have seen what the impact of that was on cancer care, on loneliness, on suicide rates, on unemployment, on poverty increasing, on the lack of access to education for children. And this time they're saying, OK, and let's be honest, most people still go along with the measures, but there is this time a debate about what does this actually mean? Now, the governments don't like to say to you, first of all, don't worry about it. This just being the next phase, because there's going to be loads of these phases for a very long time. They try to get you to focus on just a few weeks because they're worried about the public losing the appetite for following the measures. So we have this, you know, it's going to be over in 3 weeks. It's going to be over by Christmas. It's going to be over by spring next year. But I think that people need to be told, well, it's not going to be over by spring next year. It's going to rattle on for a long, long time. And you can't keep on reacting to all this terrible news and all this complicated news and all these statistics with so much energy, because you'll be exhausted. A side story, which is an analogy. When my mother was very, very sick in hospital for some time and in a care home and then back in hospital, etc., there would be endless calls from the hospital. They'd say, you need to get here this afternoon. You know, she may not make it. And you would get in the car and you would drive there in seconds, and you would be exhausted, and then she would get better and she would come out again, and then you would have another one of these crises. In the end, the one thing I think I personally took from that is, you know, you have to conserve your energy. You have to find a way of maintaining your stamina to get through things. And I think what the governments are doing in Europe is, with the way that they're managing this news, the way that they're not giving the bigger picture, in fact, they're doing a disservice. They're just making people panicky, worried, nervous, flighty. And instead of saying to them, look, this is a very long, complicated process. Take your time. But, you know, this is going to come around again and again, these waves. Then people would begin to think, OK, what does that really mean for my business? I keep on trying to get up and running every 6 weeks. What does it mean for the education of my children? What does it mean about my desire to move? All of these decisions would suddenly be in better focus, because people would be thinking, OK, I'm not making a decision about the next 6 weeks, the next 6 months. I'm making some pretty meaty decisions about how I want to get through this and how I'm going to pace myself.
Panicky, worried, nervous and flighty. I don't know why I'm moving to you now, Tom, after I read those words from Andrew. Much has been made in Parliament this week and in the papers about the UK's adherence to science. At the beginning, we didn't know what was going on and the government was firmly following the science. Now we can see that scientists who are only interested in keeping that base death rate down are suggesting that the government do lots of different things. But do we need to move this debate on a little bit about long term? Obviously, we need to keep people safe. We don't want excess deaths. But to some extent, the only way to stop this virus is to all stay indoors all of the time, which is, to some extent, the end of civilization. Are we turning a bit of a corner in this debate about just following the science or just following the economy? And are we any closer to getting the answers about what we need to do?
I think we're inching towards progress on that front. It was interesting. Chris Smith talked about an information deficit. I think it is more what Andrew said. I think it's a sort of an honesty, a transparency deficit. I don't think the public would mind being told we are going to have to be making these calculations, not for 5 weeks or 5 months, but potentially over a time horizon of, say, 5 years. I think people need to be able to put these things in context. If you're troubled as a business owner that you can't plan for the next few weeks, or if you're troubled as an individual that you feel your fundamental liberties, that your decisions to associate with people are being compromised, you need to understand the context. And I think there is a collective requirement to engage with the true likely longevity of this problem. Now, that's not to say that people aware that, you know, they may be wearing masks and having their freedom of movement restricted over a 3, 4, 5 year time horizon are going to be happy with it, or that in the short term they're going to start breaking the rules. I think fundamentally people want to go along with best practice where it makes sense, but you cannot make a properly informed decision if you are constantly being dangled this carrot of over by Christmas. I said to Andrew the other day, it reminds me of what they said about the British Expeditionary Force, you know, before World War One. We have to start making decisions based on the long-term trajectory of the pandemic.
And I just have to jump in with one tiny thing. We're not always following the science. These are political decisions. Here in the UK, we had this decision to stop pubs and restaurants being open beyond 10 o'clock. Again and again, civic leaders here in this country have asked to see the science that was behind their decision, and nobody has been able to put up the proper science to prove that that works. They're guessing, they're having a go, and quite rightly, because nobody knows how to quell this pandemic. It is not following the science. And you've seen in Berlin today a decision taken by the courts there to overturn the ruling that there was going to be new restrictions on pubs and bars, because again, they said, there is no science to this. Show us the science, and then we'll allow you to go ahead. Stop making political decisions about these things. Give people the information, and if you don't have it, be honest and say you're having a punt, because that is what is happening.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that following the science that takes into account nothing about how a country works, nothing about how the messaging works either, and a lot of complexities. So a spirited debate, and also great to hear Tom's memories from his days in the British Expeditionary Force. great to have you here, Tom. Such a wealth of knowledge.
It was quite a war.
And now let's turn to a far-flung, lesser-covered corner of the world, the United States, where yesterday confirmation hearings for Donald Trump's nominee to the US Supreme Court, that's Amy Coney Barrett, drew to a close. Coney Barrett's nomination has riled Democrats, and if her nomination is confirmed, will shift the United States' highest court resolutely to the right. Earlier, our US election correspondent Tomos Lewis unpacked the different strategies used by Democrats and Republicans during these hearings.
I think Democrats were trying to sort of compound the picture in the public mind that, you know, there are very consequential things at stake here. This isn't just a sort of part of the nation's bureaucracy. This is something that will have an effect. This is a job that has an effect in very real ways on real people's lives. And for the Republicans, they spent a lot of their time trying to characterize the Democrats as being anti-religion, as criticizing Democrats for not embracing women who have beliefs that are on the right of the political spectrum. This idea of cancel culture came up once or twice. And then much of the Republican strategy was about celebrating Amy Coney Barrett for her family. She's a mother of seven. Two of those children were adopted by her and her husband from Haiti, and for being a very devout Christian as well.
Monocle's US election correspondent and little-known fact, ukulele enthusiast and serial debtor, Tomos Lewis, with a slight sniffle there, speaking on The Globalist earlier today. Tom, election day is little over 2 weeks away. We'll be very lucky if we get a result anywhere near that time with everything that's going on. But will these hearings have any impact on voters? Is this a big part of the theatre and are people using this to get the message across? Or is this a much longer-term view about someone, a justice, who could sit on the Supreme Court for, you know, another 40 years potentially?
Well, it's very complicated, isn't it? Obviously, Trump staked quite a lot on this, and he's made it a hot button issue for voters. You know, I think his suggestion is that if they procrastinate, if they delay, if they wait, then, you know, watch what the Democrats will do. In the event that Biden gets in, it's a trickier one to balance for Biden, I think, because should he go out of his way to suggest, as some have, that, you know, the Democrats might look, if he wins, to reconfigure the court to essentially deal with this tilt to more conservative leanings that you've described by simply adding justices to the court. I think that might be an error. In a way, I think what Biden is best served doing at the moment is, in short, what he's been doing throughout the campaign, which is to say as little as possible and leave the way for Trump to dig himself in deeper. The problem, I suppose, with that is that there is a legitimate worry that with Coney Barrett, that leaning of the court to the right is set for, you know, decades. I mean, she's younger than some. I still think people should draw some small measure of comfort, not perhaps from the fact that she clerked for Justice Scalia before, who's obviously the famous sort of, you know, opposite polarity of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but the fact that she is a defender of the law. Now, some say with this very literal reading of the Constitution to a fault, but she has said explicitly, and I think she repeated this during these hearings, that she would not allow her deeply held religious convictions to shape her legal decision-making. And it could be, and we've seen the court do this a couple of times recently with some key equality votes, they have actually done, as we would see it, the right thing. And the way will be clear, should Biden win on November 3, for the Democrats to review this. And they may say, look, the Republicans essentially fought dirty by pushing this through, even though if we go back to the, you know, the second Obama term, they advocated the opposite. And then they can sort of get their own back by stacking the court later. So I think Biden should just sit tight.
Well, he said in his town hall debate that he would say before the election whether that's going to be the policy. And Andrew, I just want to talk about that briefly. Yesterday, Joe Biden and Donald Trump both took part in respective town hall style debates at the same time, which isn't great for people that wanted to watch both, instead of the slated debate between them. What do you make of this most unusual and probably the most fractious U.S. election in your memory? I mean, how do you read this?
I think you're implying my memory goes back to the days of Washington or something, but thank you very much. There was some consternation that they were both scheduled at the same time. People felt it was anti-democratic, that it wasn't encouraging voters to see both sides of the argument or what the both options available. And I don't know if that's in the end vital or not. People tend to be so polarized around this election that I'm sure that they would have watched their man, as it were. But Biden did well, and Trump, it seems, came across in his usual way as a little bit kind of mad and crazy, unable to kind of say when he'd last had these COVID tests. And but he did reveal that, you know, yes, as the New York Times had reported, that, you know, he had a large debt connected to his property business, but it said it was a small change in the way that these things go. I don't know, we have but days to go. It's been interesting watching that some of the number crunching that's been going on, that, you know, they've tried to deduct the error margin from the polls from last time when they got it so wrong, deduct that from the numbers. But even then, Biden still seems to be ahead by 4-8%. So we'll see. But at the moment, Biden is clearly doing well from being calm, from wearing a mask, from articulating a more reasoned and nuanced story than Mr. Trump.
And I find it very hard to talk in a mask, so that is a good measure of a man. And finally, we're going to end today's show with soup. Borscht, anyone? Some people like it. Others argue that borscht is the fastest way to trouble a white T-shirt. But a debate is simmering about the sour beetroot soup, beloved from Moscow to Vilnius and Donetsk. Ukraine, however, is preparing to lay its claim to borscht as it seeks to get the soup designated as a piece of intangible cultural heritage by UNESCO. In a globalised world, can a dish ever truly belong to one place? I'm thinking of the UK's claim to curry, the fact that tomatoes aren't from Italy, and the fact that the Irish wouldn't even have potatoes were it not for the Peruvians. Tom, I've seen you eat lunch, and frankly, it's a mess. It's like watching a snake devour an elephant. I didn't know a man could unhinge his jaw like that. But I'll come to you on matters of food. Is it a bit strange for a country to kind of lay claim to an entire culinary style, especially in such a globalised world? Or is that why it's important?
Well, I definitely think it's important. I think the debate is important. It's a bit like the sort of internecine battles about, you know, who makes the best hummus. I kind of like these because food tells you so much about life in a given place. And the way people, you know, sit down and break bread together or get involved in a heavy duty food fight often is a more instructive way of learning about regional history than by asking somebody. I think it's good if people want to display a bit of national pride and reclaim their soups from one another. Obviously, there's a lot of complex history in some of these geographies. I think if it increases the profile of borscht and gets people to, you know, engage with their beetroots in a different way, nothing remiss, then it's probably a good thing, isn't it?
Andrew, are you engaged in beetroots by this debate?
I can't stand beetroots. There's nothing about there's nothing about a beetroot that appeals to me. So whoever wants to
a bit of goat's cheese.
No? Whoever wants to have the soup is welcome to it. And anyone anywhere makes fennel soup, they can have that as well. My two least favourite vegetables in the world. But if there was a British soup, what would it be like? Cream of tomato, probably, do you think?
I think the Scotch are very good at their soups, aren't they? The Cullen Skink, the Mulligatawny. Very good soups.
Mulligatawny, wasn't that a hit from one of the Beatles? Paul McCartney, I think he sang Mulligatawny. I love that song. I don't mind a bit of tomato soup, but it's the bread that goes in the soup that's much nicer. I'm not really a soup person because I always feel a bit hungry after soup. It's a drink, really.
That's why you need to get some croutons involved. All soups are improved with some sort of heavy duty carbohydrate, in my view.
Yeah, French onion soup where you've got like all the bread and the melted cheese on top.
Essentially, get a baguette and some cheese involved, and I'm on board.
But it is kind of like a wet sandwich, isn't it? So it's like, again, but anyway, France.
All sandwich is good sandwich.
Well, if that hasn't whet your appetite for the weekend, I simply don't know what will. That's all the time we have on today's Late Edition. And a huge thank you to Andrew Tuck and Tom Edwards here in studio. To our producer, Carlotta Ribello. Hi, Carlotta. And to our studio manager, Louis Allen. I'm Josh Fennett, and the Late Edition is back Monday. Goodbye, have a great Friday evening and a wonderful weekend. And thanks for being with us.